WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This morning, President Bush and House leaders reached agreement on the wording of a resolution that would authorize the president to use military force against Iraq to defend national security interests and to enforce all relevant UN Security Council resolutions. My guest Kenneth Pollack has spent his entire career wrestling with the problem of Iraq. He was director for Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. Before that, he served for 7 years in the CIA as a Persian Gulf military analyst. He was in that position during the Gulf War of 1991. Pollack has written a new book called The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. We asked him to make his case. I asked him first what kind of congressional support he thinks the president should have before taking military action against Iraq.
I think it's very important that the president receive a very clear statement of support by the Congress, by the representatives of the American people. What we're embarking on is potentially a very big military operation. And what's more, the military operation itself may be the easiest part of what we're doing. The reconstruction of Iraq afterwards may make the military operation itself pale by comparison. And given that it is going to be such a big operation and potentially could cost many lives, I think it is critical that the administration have the declared consent of the Congress for this operation.
In your new book, you make a case for invading Iraq. Do you think President Bush has made the best case for invading Iraq? What would you add or what would you counter to the case the president has made?
I am concerned with the way that the administration is trying to build the case against Saddam Hussein. I don't think that they've done the best job that they could. First of all, I think that they're bringing in a lot of extraneous elements, suggesting that somehow Iraqi attacks in the no-fly zones are somehow a violation of their commitment to disarmament. They are violating their obligations under inspections. It's just that the no-fly zones and the inspections are two different things. And I think that by bringing in all of these other variables, the administration is confusing the American people and conveying a sense that they just want to go to war with Saddam Hussein regardless of anything else and are willing to fixate on anything to make the case. In point of fact, as I try to do in this new book, I try to lay out the fact that there is a very powerful, compelling case for war with Iraq. And that case is built around Saddam Hussein's determination to acquire nuclear weapons and his past, his behavior in power as Iraq's leader that make Iraq uniquely threatening. You know, a lot of people have been asking very important questions, in particular, why is Iraq different from other countries? And I think that there is a very strong case to be made that Iraq is different because of Saddam's demonstrated behavior. We've had 34 years of experience with him in power, and what we've seen during that period of time is this is a very, very unstable regime, which has a leader who makes decisions based on what it is he wants to believe, and oftentimes makes decisions that no one else around him and certainly no one outside of Iraq would have made, based on calculations that no one around him and no one outside of Iraq would share. That makes him very dangerous. If he has nuclear weapons, I think we need to be very concerned about how he will use them, how he will try to expand Iraq's power and influence in the region, using those nuclear weapons to try to stand off the United States. And I think that is the most powerful and the most compelling case. And I've yet to hear the administration articulate it.
Well, let me ask you a question a lot of Americans are asking, which is, why now? What's changed?
From a strategic perspective, I don't think that there is a compelling reason that we have to do it in the next month or two. The problem that we have with Iraq is Saddam's development of nuclear weapons. The best estimates that the intelligence community and that the intelligence communities of other countries like Britain, France, and Germany have is that Saddam is probably 4 to 6 years away from having a nuclear weapon unless he can buy fissile material on the black market, which he's not been able to do successfully. Now, the intelligence communities have been wrong in the past, and therefore that estimate of 4 to 6 years needs to be treated very carefully. And what that suggests is that we want to err on the side of caution. And the last thing you want to do is to get that wrong and to wait until after Saddam Hussein has a nuclear weapon. Because once that happens, invasion is off the table and we are going to be left living in this very, very dangerous world of a very unpredictable and capricious dictator with nuclear weapons. By the same token, we want to make sure that when we go into Iraq, we are in a position to take that regime down very quickly. And then we also want to be in a position where we can rebuild Iraq and start rebuilding very quickly and very thoroughly and be in a position to commit ourselves to the long and costly process of rebuilding Iraq.
Now, the Bush administration started pushing for regime change in Iraq after September 11th. And a lot of Americans are wondering, wait a minute, doesn't regime change in Iraq deflect attention from the war against terrorism? And terrorism is the absolute immediate threat that we face. So what would your answer to that be?
Let me make a couple of points. First off, I think that it certainly is an important fact to keep in mind that a war against Iraq could distract the United States from the war on terrorism. And that is certainly something I'm concerned about. Unfortunately, it's also something that it's very difficult for a private citizen to make a real good judgment about, because unfortunately, the war against terrorism is one being fought in the shadows. And really, only the president and his closest advisors, who have access to all of the classified information, have a very good sense of how the war on terrorism is going, and in particular, how the war against al-Qaeda is going. I think that it is important that the United States have driven al-Qaeda down to a point where it will be very difficult for them to attack us while we are off in Iraq, and it will be difficult for Saddam Hussein to take advantage of al-Qaeda, to give them weapons of mass destruction or encourage them in other ways to attack us. So I would like to be certain that when we go into Iraq, al-Qaeda may not be eradicated, but that it has been weakened enough that we can have confidence that they won't be in such a position.
From what I'm reading, it sounds like there are people high-placed in the military and the Pentagon who disagree with the Bush administration and think that it will be difficult for us to have a quick overthrow of Saddam Hussein and that it will take away from the war on terrorism.
I think there's no question that it already is starting to take away from it. We're already diverting intelligence assets from trying to track down al-Qaeda terrorists to trying to prepare ourselves for the war in Iraq. Again, the question is how much so, and is it really having an impact? You're right. We're hearing voices from the military who are complaining that they think that it is having a detrimental effect on the war on terrorism. Unfortunately, again, it's very difficult for private citizens who don't have access to classified information. And again, I am now out of the government, so I'm in the same position. It's hard for us to really know what the truth of that is. What I say in the book is I think that the president needs to be able to be in a position where if we do attack Iraq, and if there is an al-Qaeda terrorist attack here in the United States during that time, and you cannot rule that out, that he needs to be able to look the families of the victims in the eye and be able to say them in all truth that there was nothing about what we were doing in Iraq that made it more likely that their loved one died. If the president can meet that standard, then I think that's reasonable. But I think that the president needs to ask that question, and his advisors need to ask that question and look at it very hard before they are ready to go into Iraq.
Do you think there's any evidence that Iraq is in league with al-Qaeda?
The evidence I've seen is very weak. Throughout the 1990s, we saw Iraq and al-Qaeda trying to make tentative contact with each other, mostly the Iraqis trying to reach out to al-Qaeda. In every case that we were aware of, the meetings came to nothing. The Iraqis and al-Qaeda simply couldn't come to a meeting of the minds. They have very different agendas. I mean, at the end of the day, Osama bin Laden would like to destroy Saddam Hussein's regime as well. He's just further down the list from the United States and Saudi Arabia. Iraq also has always been, well, I shouldn't say always been, but Iraq has for a number of years been very leery of international terrorist groups because they're hard for Iraq to control. And Saddam likes to have people working for him who are under his complete control. Terrorists are freelancers. If you give them weapons of mass destruction, you just don't know what they're going to do with them. Now, Secretary Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice have been making some very strong accusations indicating that there is new evidence that these ties are much more extensive than we knew about in the past, or that there are new ties which are much more extensive than they were in the past. If that's the case, I think they're going to need to make a much stronger, more compelling case. In particular, I don't hear anyone in the Congress convinced of this. And since they are also getting the classified briefings, you would think that they would be aware of the information that the administration is privy to, and that they would be convinced. The fact that they have not yet been convinced makes me a little bit leery of the information that the administration is claiming is so strong.
Now, a word you don't hear the Bush administration say in regards to invading Iraq is oil. And a lot of skeptics are wondering, you know, let's face it, we're talking about the region that we rely on for oil. Is there an unspoken agenda here that is really about oil? And that question takes on more significance for skeptics when they factor in that, you know, President Bush and Vice President Cheney have backgrounds in the oil business. So do you think that there is an unspoken oil agenda that is involved with the regime change plan?
Sure. Well, let me start by saying I think that there are bad reasons related to oil and good reasons related to oil. The bad reasons related to oil, as you suggest, are that somehow this is the doing of the oil companies, that they are pressing the administration, or simply the administration, given its ties to the oil companies, is doing this on its own, believing this would be best for the oil companies. People have suggested that the Iraqi opposition, if they became the new leadership in Iraq, would cut sweetheart deals with the oil companies, would make payoffs, and that this would be beneficial to the oil companies. Others have suggested that if the United States, quote-unquote, got control over Iraq's oil, it would make Saudi oil less valuable. These are all theories out there. I don't think there's any, I've not seen any proof to substantiate them. They are conspiracy theories. You know, it's a conspiratorial town. I can't say categorically that they are right or wrong. But I think that there is another issue that is related to oil that I think that we need to think about, think very hard about, because it affects all of us and it could affect all of us in terms of our daily lives. And that is, if Saddam Hussein does acquire nuclear weapons, one of the most frightening scenarios that we can think of is that he might do something to the Persian Gulf oil fields. Right now, about 25% of the world's oil comes from the Persian Gulf. That number is expected to increase over the next 10 to 20 years as China and India continue to develop and demand more and more oil. Because not only has the Persian Gulf got the largest reserves in the world, it's also got the largest potential for expansion in the world. And the problem that we have is if Saddam could eliminate Persian Gulf oil from the market by conquering Kuwait and dropping nuclear weapons on the Saudi oil fields, which is obviously an extreme scenario, but also certainly not out of the question, you would remove 22 to 25% of the world's oil. And in talking to economists, what they will tell you is a blow like that would send the entire global economy into a recession, at least on the scale of the Great Depression of the 1930s, if not worse. I mean, we need to face up to the fact that we are not just a country, but a world addicted to cheap oil. All of our economies are based on it. And if all of a sudden you were to wipe out 25% of the world's oil or simply take it off the market, you would do enormous damage to the global economy. It's one of the reasons why I'd love to see a better energy policy in addition to a stronger policy with regard to Iraq. And this is a problem that we are going to face for as long as we are dependent on oil, regardless of who rules in Iraq.
My guest is Kenneth Pollack, author of the new book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kenneth Pollack. He was the director of Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council under the Clinton administration, and he also was an Iran-Iraq military analyst at the CIA. He's written a new book called The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. During the 91 Gulf War, you were a junior analyst in the CIA's Iran-Iraq military operation, and I'm wondering if you could describe for us what you were looking at during the Gulf War.
Sure. Well, for me, the Gulf War began on about July 17th, 1990, when we began to see Iraqi tanks showing up on the Kuwaiti border. This was right after both Saddam and his then foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, had given incredibly inflammatory speeches accusing Kuwait of economic warfare against Iraq and threatening all kinds of consequences if the Kuwaitis didn't stop. And very soon after those tanks began showing up on the Iraqi border, in fact, within a day or two, I became convinced that the Iraqis were going to invade Kuwait. And at the time, I was very much in the minority within the U.S. intelligence community. In fact, all through the buildup for the invasion of Kuwait, I was in the minority. In fact, to my knowledge, I was only one of three people in the whole intelligence community who were warning that this was, in fact, an Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. There were a number of people who were willing to believe that the Iraqis might try some kind of a show of force, maybe seize these two offshore islands that Kuwait possessed that Iraq wanted, and maybe seized the southern half of the Rumaila oil field, which straddled their border. But there was an even larger group of people who just didn't believe the Iraqis would use force at all. And it was one of my first and most frustrating experiences trying to convince both my peers in the intelligence community and the policymakers downtown that, no, the Iraqis really were going to invade. They were going to seize all of Kuwait. And, you know, we didn't know what beyond that, but clearly they were going to take all of Kuwait. And what we found was, or at least what I found was, not only was I going up against the intelligence community, but I was going up against all of our Arab allies who kept assuring the Bush administration that Saddam Hussein wasn't crazy, he wasn't going to do anything that drastic, that this was all just a summer cloud that would pass quickly if the United States just stayed out. And then after the Gulf War, we were also very deeply involved in trying to assess what was going on in Iraq while the two large revolts broke out against Saddam Hussein, the one in the south led mostly by Shiite Iraqis and in the north mostly by Kurdish Iraqis. And there as well had some run-ins with the administration because U.S. Central Command, the command that is responsible for all U.S. forces in the region and that had run the Gulf War, had an imperfect understanding of what they had done to Iraqi forces during the Gulf War. There were many units that had reported that they had destroyed entire Iraqi Republican Guard divisions, when in some cases they had only destroyed part of the division. And we started early on letting the decision makers downtown at the White House and the State Department know that, in point of fact, a lot of the Republican Guard had actually escaped. And I think that was very disconcerting for the Bush administration, because one of the reasons that they had been willing to stop the war on February 28th was that they were under the impression that far more of the Republican Guard had actually been destroyed than was the case. It was, you know, one of these instances of the real fog of war. And it's important to keep in mind that, you know, even in this age of our nanotechnology, where we think that we know everything that's going on the battlefield, the fog of war is still a very heavy presence and can lead to some mistaken decisions.
Okay, as somebody who was very involved in analysis, intelligence analysis, during the Gulf War, what are some of the lessons you think we should learn from the Gulf War and apply to the situation we're in now?
I think the first and most important is the danger of mirror imaging. Again, it was something that I came across frequently. Policymakers and even other intelligence analysts who tried very hard to understand Saddam Hussein by asking the question, what would I do if I were in Saddam Hussein's shoes? Now, it's a very understandable approach, and it's a very common approach. The problem is it's a very treacherous approach with Saddam Hussein, because what we have learned over the 34 years that he has been in power in Iraq is that Saddam Hussein doesn't think like you or I. In fact, he doesn't think like most Iraqis. As best we understand it, many of the most important decisions he's taken, all of the people around him, or at least the vast majority of the people around him, recognized were deeply mistaken decisions. But because Saddam is so brutal and is so perfectly willing to shoot the messenger, to shoot anyone who brings him bad news, under most circumstances, his advisors, his intelligence people, keep their mouths shut and tend to tell him what he wants to hear, something that simply reinforces his penchant to miscalculate. And the more that we ask ourselves the question, what would I do if I were in Saddam Hussein's shoes, the more likely we are to misjudge what it is he's actually likely to do, because he doesn't think like us, and the inputs into his decision-making are very bizarre, and oftentimes we don't know what those inputs are until well after the fact. And this means that you need to treat Saddam Hussein very, very carefully. You need to treat him almost in a way that you don't treat most other leaders, in the sense of looking mostly at his capabilities and asking things like, what is the worst case scenario with this guy, rather than asking what is he most likely to do, because under most circumstances, we really don't know what he is most likely to do.
Since you worked with the CIA during the Bush administration, I'm wondering if you think that any of the people in the Bush administration now who were in the Bush senior administration then have this kind of personal thing going on with Saddam Hussein or with the war in Iraq? In other words, like, we left this unfinished. Here we are back in the White House, and we're going to take care of it this time around. Or in the case of President Bush, you know, they did this to my father, you know, in 91. I'm in the White House this time, and they're not going to get away with it any longer. You know, is it personal?
I certainly was very disconcerted by that remark by the president the other day that, you know, he tried to kill my daddy. It's certainly true. He did try to kill George Bush Sr., no question about that. And certainly Saddam believes in revenge. I don't think that revenge should be a guiding principle of American foreign policy, however. If there are people in the Bush administration who have personal vendettas against Saddam Hussein for whatever reason, you know, that's fine for them. That's all well and good. I certainly hope that that's not shaping their decision making for U.S. foreign policy. I think that U.S. foreign policy needs to be made purely on the basis of what is in the best interests of the United States as a country.
Kenneth Pollack is the author of the new book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. He's now director of research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kenneth Pollack, author of the new book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. He says he makes the case grudgingly and reluctantly, knowing that war with Iraq could be difficult and expensive and could result in thousands of deaths. But based on his understanding of Saddam Hussein, he thinks invasion is our best option. Pollack worked at the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. During the Gulf War, he worked with the CIA as a Persian Gulf military expert. You directed Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. What would you say were the Clinton administration's goals for Iraq?
Throughout the Clinton administration, there were some very fierce debates over Iraq. The Clinton administration itself was deeply divided over how to handle Iraq. Everyone in the administration recognized that Saddam Hussein was pure evil, and he ruled over an odious regime that was going to make trouble for the United States if it couldn't be kept in check, if it couldn't be prevented from acquiring the weapons of mass destruction, which would give it the ability to really threaten U.S. interests in the region and potentially throughout the world. The question really came down to, what do you do about it, and what are your priorities? And the debate in the Clinton administration throughout this period of time centered on those issues and centered on how much effort the United States had to make to keep Saddam contained. Now, there were a number of people, myself included, who felt that we needed to mount some kind of a regime change effort. But it was more a sense of we needed to set ourselves up in the hope that we could be lucky and get this guy with some kind of a covert action program, and also to keep pressure on him, because at least those like myself who felt that Saddam Hussein was a real threat and would be challenging the containment regime regularly felt that it was important for the U.S. to be pushing back as hard as we could and on a constant basis. But you had others in the administration who really, their agenda was elsewhere in the world. And even though I didn't agree with them, I could never fault them. And their point was that the United States was at a unique moment in time. The Soviet Union had collapsed. The Cold War was over. The entire world was in a state of flux. And their feeling was the United States had to be ready and willing and devoting all of its resources to trying to craft a new world order, to make the Soviet Union into a democracy, to expand NATO, to create a democratic NATO from, you know, the Atlantic to the Urals, to build a new relationship with China and move them on a peaceful course, to build a new relationship with India, to help out the struggling nations of the world that were trying to develop themselves economically. And these were all their priorities. And, you know, for those of us who worked on Iraq, we had to explain to them why containment required a greater effort. And oftentimes it was hard because containment, at least early on, was a very strong policy and weakened only over time.
Now, it was your job directing Gulf Affairs for the National Security Council to develop realistic options for regime change. What did that mean exactly? And in other words, were you developing options for overthrowing Saddam Hussein or options to replace Saddam Hussein after he was overthrown?
Both.
Okay.
When I came, I did two tours at the National Security Council, and when I came back in 1999, It was right after Operation Desert Fox, the four-day airstrikes that the United States launched against Saddam in December of 1998. And it was right after President Clinton's announcement that the United States would be pursuing a policy of regime change. And when I came back on, the administration turned to me and to my boss and said, we're serious about this. We want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, that we are losing the support of the world. The world is turning away from us, and therefore we don't have a multilateral containment regime anymore that we can really rely on. And therefore, we need to get rid of him. And so we started to try to develop options to do exactly that, to get him out of power and to create a new Iraq, one that would abide by its obligations to the international community and that could hopefully live in peace in the Middle East with its neighbors.
Did you look at the possibility of assassination?
The United States has been, put it very bluntly, the United States has been trying to assassinate Saddam Hussein since 1991. We tried during the Gulf War using air power. The CIA mounted other efforts to overthrow him since then. The problem we had was really not the will. I mean, everyone recognized, again, that Saddam Hussein was pure evil and that if he could be eliminated, the world would be a much better place. And truth to tell, while there, I think many people believe that assassination is against the law, in point of fact, that's not correct. And the president is empowered to remove foreign leaders under certain circumstances. And the Clinton administration lawyers believe that those circumstances were met. And so did the Bush administration lawyers believe that those circumstances were met and tried very hard to do so. But what we found is also actually what the Iranians found and the Syrians found and the Israelis found and the Saudis have found, all other countries that tried to remove Saddam Hussein, is that it's very, very hard to do.
Why is it so hard?
There's one thing in this world that Saddam Hussein is good at, and that's keeping himself in power in Iraq. He has built an elaborate police state modeled on the police state built by Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union, but which I think actually goes way beyond what Stalin ever achieved. He has multiple redundant security services, all of which watch him, watch each other. They compete with each other. They pry into every aspect of Iraqi society. They are thorough. They are relentless. They are brutal. They have everything wired, everything bugged. And what's more, they use torture and force on such a routine basis to extract information and to intimidate the population that the vast majority of Iraqis are simply terrified. And penetrating Saddam's rings of security are extremely difficult, and so far, no one, not the United States, not Israel, not Syria, not Iran, not Saudi Arabia, has ever been able to do it.
Now, a question that had to be faced when you were directing Persian Gulf affairs at the National Security Council, and that has to be faced by the Bush administration now, is if there is success in overthrowing Saddam Hussein, then what? Who replaces him? What does that government look like? I know that the Bush administration is looking in part to Iraqi exiles now, and I'm wondering if you think that there really is the possibility for good leadership to emerge from those groups that the CIA has been working with and talking to in exile.
Sure. That really is a critical question. I think we need to be very, very clear that rebuilding Iraq is a necessary component of invading and taking down Saddam Hussein's regime. Allowing Iraq to go its own way, to slip back into chaos and warlordism and civil war, much as I'm afraid we are allowing Afghanistan to do, really isn't an option in the case of Iraq. Iraq is too important a country and too important a region of the world to allow that to happen. Now, that said, the opposition are out there, and I think that they can play a helpful role in the rebuilding, but I think that we have to be very careful about how much we entrust that mission to them, simply because we don't know how the Iraqis inside Iraq feel about the exiles. There are many exiles who are perfectly nice, smart, patriotic, creative, well-meaning individuals. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the people who the Iraqis will want to lead them. And in many cases, we have reasons to be concerned that some of the exiles really don't have very good ties to people inside, are not well-known, are not very popular. For that reason, I think it would be a mistake for the United States to, for example, nominate a provisional government from among the exiles and, walk into Iraq, invade the country, drive in, and then say, congratulations, meet your new government. Because I think that many of the Iraqis would look at the people we brought in and say, who are these guys? You know, where have they been for the last 20 years while we were suffering under Saddam's rule? Why should we allow them to be our new government?
My guest is Kenneth Pollack, author of the new book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kenneth Pollack, author of the new book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. He served for 7 years in the CIA as a Persian Gulf military analyst. In the Clinton administration, he was the National Security Council's Director of Gulf Affairs. Do you really see a possible scenario in which the new Iraqi government is not a puppet government of the United States? We're going to be investing, if this happens, we're going to be investing a lot of time, money, and American lives in overthrowing Saddam Hussein, and the American government is going to want its best interests represented in the new Iraqi government, and in a way that's like the perfect scenario for, you know, a puppet government installed in, you know, that looks a whole lot like a democracy but isn't exactly.
Yeah, I think that would be a terrible mistake for the United States. And there are a lot of mistakes that the U.S. can make in rebuilding Iraq. This is the problem. There are a lot of ways to get the rebuilding of Iraq wrong and only a few ways to get it right. And I think it is critical that we do get it right. And that means a very long-term commitment, allowing the U.N. and the international community to build democracy from the ground up in Iraq, which is going to be a long process. Potentially a costly one. I mean, the very important bright note there is that Iraq's oil revenues can almost certainly cover the vast majority, if not all, of those reconstruction costs, which would make Iraq very different from other countries where we've done this, say Germany, Japan, Bosnia, Kosovo, East Timor. But nevertheless, we need to be committed to this long process because if we do just try to install some kind of a puppet government, some leader who is nothing but a facade for the United States, I think that that person will be rejected very quickly by the Iraqi people, and you will see a quick slide into fragmentation, into chaos, into warlordism, into civil war.
Okay, you say we have to go in with massive force. I want to quote something from your new book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. You write, "The only prudent and realistic course of action left to the United States is to mount a full-scale invasion of Iraq, to smash the Iraqi armed forces, end Saddam's regime, and rid the country of weapons of mass destruction." Then you say, "Every time I say or write this, I find myself wondering whether it is truly necessary." Can you talk about that little war within yourself, about how much force you think we need to do and how extreme you think our action needs to be?
Sure. I mean, the debate that I have within myself is not over the amount of force, actually. It's whether we need to do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if we're going to do it, there is no question we need to bring overwhelming force. Again, this is not a war that you want to try to win just barely. We won't get any points for style, and no one's going to clap any louder if we win this war with only 50,000 troops than if we win it with 250,000 troops. I spent much of the last 10, 12 years trying to make containment work, and I believed very strongly that containment could be made to work, and I still believe to this day that if we had done things differently and if our allies had done things differently, containment could have been made to work much longer than was actually the case. I recognize that a war with Iraq is going to be costly and potentially risky. And, I don't particularly like the idea of espousing massive military operations where potentially hundreds or thousands of people may die. Unfortunately, what my analysis keeps bringing me back to is I don't think that we have any other alternative. I don't think that we have any other course of action left to us at this point in time, so late in the game, to prevent a much larger, much deadlier war. And this is really, I think, the choice that we face, is that if we do not head off Saddam's nuclear weapons programs, and the only way that we are really going to be able to do that is through an invasion, because the inspections, the sanctions are not going to be able to do it. If we can't keep Saddam from gaining those weapons of mass destruction, the nuclear weapons in particular, I believe that we are likely to wind up in a nuclear confrontation, if not a nuclear war with Saddam Hussein at some point in the future. And to me, that prospect is so terrifying that it brings me right back to the justification for we need to do this. We need to invade. We need to eradicate Saddam's regime and its weapons of mass destruction so that we don't ever have to face that horrifying scenario.
And you say you'd like to think the containment can work, but you think it's been handled badly and that it's not going to work. By containment, does that include the UN weapons inspections? Have you given up on that?
Oh, absolutely. Again, I was a huge supporter of the UN inspections. I think that if handled differently, they might have worked even better than they did. But there are many points to be made here. Let me just make two of them about the inspections and the inherent problems with the inspections. The first problem with the inspections is that the inspections were always dependent on international goodwill. Without international support, the inspections can't work. We can't forcibly disarm Saddam Hussein using inspections. Remember, the inspections were set up at the end of the Gulf War to do nothing more than inspect. The Iraqis were supposed to destroy all of their weapons of mass destruction, and all the UN teams were supposed to do was to go in and inspect and certify that Iraq had, in fact, destroyed everything. They were never intended to try to forcibly compel Saddam to give up his weapons of mass destruction, and in fact, no one ever believed they could. And what we found by 1996 was that they couldn't, because we just didn't know where anything was. That by 1996, Saddam Hussein had gotten so good at hiding his weapons of mass destruction programs that the inspectors couldn't find anything. We had no idea where to look. And it wasn't just the inspectors. It was CIA and all of the other foreign intelligence services who were supporting the inspectors. We didn't know where they were. All of this suggests that, A, you know, we're not going to be able to make the inspections work again in the future because we just don't have international support. And we certainly could get the UN to pass any kind of a new resolution on inspections if we give them the alternative of either pass it or we'll invade. But the problem is 6 or 12 or 18 months down the road, Saddam will again start to cheat. And I think all the evidence is that the rest of the world will once again start to ignore it. And we'll find ourselves exactly where we were back in 1998. Not knowing where the weapons were, not being able to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that he has them, and effectively alone in being the only nation willing to actually try to back up the inspectors and to make that program work. And the problem is that if that happens again in the future, we may find ourselves so much closer with Saddam Hussein having a nuclear weapon at that point in time.
If we do go to war with Iraq, what do you think the odds are that Iraq would use weapons of mass destruction against our troops or against Israel?
I
say biological or chemical weapons is what I mean there more specifically. Yeah.
I think it's a virtual certainty that Iraq will try to use its weapons of mass destruction both against our troops and against our allies in the region, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Jordan, you name it. That's why I think that an invasion of Iraq needs to be massive and overwhelming, because if we bring all of our capabilities, we have very good ways to counter all of those different threats. I'll give you one example. It's going to be very difficult for Saddam Hussein to hit Israel with anything but Scuds. Their aircraft are highly unlikely to be able to get through. They might try a terrorist operation, but that's tough also because Israel is, you know, so tightly controlled and will be looking for that stuff very closely. Their best way to deliver biological and chemical agents against Israel, as they did during the Gulf War, is to put it on the nose of a Scud missile and launch it. But if the United States brings enough force that we can seize Western Iraq, we can effectively eliminate that threat because Iraq's Scuds have a limited range. They have to be launched from Western Iraq. And during the Gulf War, we tried to deny Western Iraq to their Scud forces using nothing but air forces and special forces. And ultimately, it was inadequate. It couldn't quite do the job. Today, our air forces and our special forces are actually much more capable than they were in 1991, but still no one can be certain that they can do the job of eliminating all the Scuds in Western Iraq. But if we bring enough force to actually occupy Western Iraq, we can have a high degree of confidence that Saddam Hussein will not be able to launch too many Scuds, perhaps not any. And it's those kind of measures that the United States can take that can greatly minimize Saddam's ability to launch weapons of mass destruction.
Bottom line question, you're confident we need to invade Iraq, use a lot of force to do it, to get the job done right, and to help rebuild Iraq afterwards so that there's stability in the region and stability in the world. Okay, bottom line, are you confident that it's going to go well, that we're going to do it, you know, right by your standards, and that on the other end of this war, if there is one, will emerge better and stronger and more stable, as opposed to the world will emerge in just in a more disastrous situation?
Right now, in early October of 2002, I can't say that I have seen everything from the administration that I would want to see that will convince me that we are going to do this right. I'm still waiting for a whole bunch of stuff to fall into place. I am hopeful that the administration will do the necessary, but as I said, I've not yet seen it.
And if we don't do it right, do you think we're better off not doing it at all?
That's the hardest question of all. I hope we do it right, and I hope that we don't have to make that kind of a decision, because if we do it wrong, we could create as many problems as we solve. But if we don't do it at all, we could face some truly terrible choices down the road.
Sounds like you think we're at a pretty precarious moment.
I think this is an important moment for the country, and I think it's important that we get this right. And just along those lines, a question you asked earlier on, just to reiterate it, this is something that I think needs to happen sooner rather than later, and I certainly don't have any problem with doing it this winter. But I also think that an argument can be made that if it is necessary to hold it off for a longer period of time to make sure that we can do it right, I think that that may be necessary too.
Kenneth Pollack, thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Kenneth Pollack is the author of the new book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. He's now director of research at the Brookings Institution's Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. This is Fresh Air.